Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the showdown in the Senate expected on Thursday when and if the Republicans block the nomination of Patricia Mallette to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals that is likely to provoke the so-called nuclear option to rein in the filibuster. Nan Aron, the president and founder of the Alliance for Justice, joins us to discuss the brazen blockage of Obama's judicial nominations to the second most important court in the land. Then we'll get an update on Wednesday's conference on retirement security in Washington in support of protecting Social Security in advance of any grand bargain that might put it in on the chopping block as budget talks begin and the cost of living adjustment for 2014 is announced at 1.5%, the lowest since the COLA was introduced in 1975. Eric Kingston, the founding co-director of the Social Security Works, the organization behind the Strengthened Social Security Coalition, joins us to discuss the forces arrayed to protect Social Security against the powerful interests who want to either cut its benefits or privatize it. Then finally, we'll look into the arrests by the Chinese Public Security Bureau of five ethnic Uyghurs who are being described as Islamic jihadists responsible for an audacious attack at the foot of the Tiananmen Gate near the political heart of the nation. A leading expert on China's ethnic minorities, and in particular the Uyghurs, Drew Gladney, joins us. He is a professor of anthropology at Pomona College and author of Muslim Chinese Ethnic Nationalism in the People's Republic. And joining us now is Nan Aron, who is the president and founder of the Alliance for Justice, a national association of over 100 organizations working to promote and protect public interest in national policy. A leading voice in public interest law for over 30 years, she's the author of Liberty and Justice for All, Public Interest Law in the 1980s and Beyond. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nan Aron.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And on Thursday, it appears to be a kind of showdown that's happening in the Senate, in the Judiciary Committee, over the appointment to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit of Patricia Ann Millett, who apparently has been chosen because she has a bipartisan appeal and there is nothing objectionable about her, yet the Republicans are basically at this point saying that they're going to filibuster her or not allow her nomination to proceed. And Harry Reid's now talking of invoking the nuclear option. What do you expect is going to happen on Thursday, Nan?
She will be brought up for a vote before the full Senate. And I assume that Harry Reid will not have the votes to proceed to confirm Patty Mallette to the D.C. Circuit. She is an incredibly strong candidate for the seat. Republicans, despite her stellar credentials, have been fighting to keep open the remaining three seats on an 11-judge court. There is now an even split on the D.C. Circuit for Democratic appointments, for Republican appointments, and it is the desire of the Republicans, both on the Senate Judiciary Committee and probably in the Senate, not to allow any more judges to be confirmed because out of their fear that one more Democratic-appointed judge would tilt the balance in favor of the Democrats' positions on issues. So there is a war being waged over, really, these seats. And unfortunately, the victims are Patty Mallette and Nina Pillard and Robert Wilkins, all three supremely qualified candidates. This fight has really nothing to do with their qualifications. They are as capable as any judge we've seen confirmed to the D.C. Circuit. The fight is over whether Republicans will allow the majority leader to begin to take votes to fill these three seats.
Well, this particular seat, though, has been vacant since Chief Justice John Roberts was elevated 8 years ago to the Supreme Court. And it is a, of course, this circuit court is a conduit directly to the Supreme Court, where four Supreme Court justices in the last 30 years have been elevated from this court to the Supreme Court. So, but the idea that this has been vacant for 8 years and it's been dominated by conservatives and now it has an even split. What I find extraordinary, though, is the fatuous nature of the arguments that Senator Cornyn, himself a judge, has come up with, and that is that he's invoking the national debt, saying that the salary of a new judge that he claims we don't need on this court has something to do with the $17 trillion deficit that we have. I mean, what is a judge's salary? Surely that's not going to tip the balance and bankrupt the country, is it?
Senator Cornyn has raised these silly objections. Senator Grassley wants to eliminate one seat and send two of the seats to the Second and the Ninth Circuit. But these are all pretexts, excuses by Republicans not to fill these three seats. It's that simple. And here you've got, as you say, Patty Mollett. She was an assistant to the Solicitor General for several years. She's been honored by the Bush administration with the Attorney General's Distinguished Service Award. She's argued, I think, something like 32 cases in the Supreme Court. You really couldn't find anyone better credentialed for the D.C. Circuit. And yet, Republicans are coming up with any excuse they can possibly think of to make sure that a vote is never taken on her confirmation. Their most recent excuse is to say that the caseload is too small for the D.C. Circuit. And yet, during the Bush administrations, judges were confirmed to the 9th, 10th, and 11th seats when the caseloads were even lower. So we know this has nothing to do with the court, nothing to do with Patty Mollett or the other two. It is simply a power move on part of the Republicans to prevent the Obama administration from filling these three seats.
Again, I'm speaking with Nan Aaron, who is the president and founder of the Alliance for Justice, a national association of over 100 organizations working to promote and protect public interest in national policy, a leading voice in public interest law for over 30 years. She's the author of Liberty and Justice for All, Public Interest Law in the 1980s and Beyond. But, of course, this court is very, very important in as much as it gets to decide what laws and regulations come out of important federal agencies. A very, very important case was just heard recently, Verizon versus the FCC, and its ruling could have massive implications for Americans and for their freedom. The last avenue of complete freedom of the press, given, you know, a disenchantment with so many Americans with the mainstream press, has been the internet. Now, obviously, you've got to navigate it carefully, but it is a very free forum, and it's a bottom-up forum where your news is not dictated by corporate interests. And Verizon is trying to basically take over the internet in as much as the way the cable companies control the pipeline into your house and decide what television you can watch. And this will be a catastrophe for free speech for all Americans. So, I mean,
the D.C. Circuit is unique, principally because of its caseload. As you've just described, it hears extraordinarily complex cases involving national security, involving regulations, involving a whole host of matters involving the federal government. But it's also critically important because the D.C. Circuit has been, in the past, a stepping stone to the Supreme Court. Four of the nine current justices served on the D.C. Circuit: Roberts, Ginsburg, Scalia, and Thomas. And because the Supreme Court can only hear a very limited number of cases each year. Frequently, the D.C. Circuit's decisions serve as law of the land because the Supreme Court doesn't hold appeals on most of their decisions. So basically, the D.C. Circuit, in most instances, renders the final law of the land. So it is a critically important court, sometimes considered the second most important court in the country.
So, Nan Aaron, what is the Senator Grassley, who's the minority chair of the Judiciary Committee, what in the Senate, what's he doing over on the House side before the Ways and Means Committee of the House, where he's sort of whipping up the Republicans in the House over this appointment to the D.C. Circuit Court, when, of course, the House has no jurisdiction? So what's he trying to do? He's the guy that's talking about this is about stacking the court, you know, a reference back to when Roosevelt was so frustrated with the Supreme Court that he considered stacking it.
Right. Well, Senator Grassley's on a mission to whip up enthusiasm for his idea to essentially leave unfilled three seats on the D.C. Circuit. It is a pure political move. There's no support for Senator Grassley's views on this matter. The Judicial Conference, which is led by Chief Justice Roberts, has noted often the true significance of the D.C. Circuit. Committees have certainly indicated that the D.C. Circuit needs to be fully staffed with 11 judges. So Senator Grassley is off trying to get support from House Republicans for the idea that they simply should shut down the judiciary. They shut down the rest of government, and now Senator Grassley basically wants to, for solely political reasons, keep the D.C. Circuit as is. Again, during the Bush years, when the workload was even lower than it is now, Senator Grassley was pushing as hard as he possibly could to fill those vacancies. And now he makes the argument, hypocritically, that the workload is so low that we don't need three judges. But there's no authority, there's no justification anywhere that supports that notion. If anything, anyone who's reviewed this matter has indicated that these seats must be filled. So this means that there will be a showdown in the Senate over the next several weeks. We are going to see most likely the two other nominees to the D.C. Circuit filibustered by the Republicans, which will result in the majority leader, Harry Reid's, decision most likely to threaten to change the Senate's filibuster rules. I think he's quite willing, if these three nominees are filibuster, to argue that we've got to do something about these filibusters. They're based not on the merits, only on politics, and there will be, I'm sure, a very significant and raucous and robust debate in the Senate over the Senate rules, and hopefully at the end of this debate we can see these three incredibly qualified candidates confirmed to this important circuit.
But what about the rest of the backlog, Nan Aaron? This president has, and he's been criticized for not being aggressive in pushing through his judicial nominees. And my understanding is, compared to his predecessors, Clinton and George W. Bush, the Obama administration is way behind in filling the courts, largely because of these easy filibusters that the Republicans have usurped this idea that everything has to have 60 votes in order to pass. And this is a whole new ball game, which has led us to the point where they may have to change the rules. And many Democratic senators, particularly the more seasoned ones, are very concerned that this thing may backfire when they're in the minority. So it's not an easy step to make. So if you're going to go to the mat for three judges on this on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, why not go to the mat for the whole bunch of them? You know, how many are in the backlog? Do you know?
It's different. There are about, I think, 109 vacancies. About a tenth of the judiciary are vacancies. But two things are worth noting. Number one, President Obama has stepped up the pace of nominations, and I'm just thrilled to see that that's happened. Having said that, though, there are places around the country where there are one or two Republican senators who are on the record refusing to support some of the president's nominees. And that means that they cannot get hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. There is some known rule called the blue slip rule in the Senate, which requires home state senators to approve district court appointments, district court nominees, before hearings are given. And because of this rule, Republican senators are withholding support from numerous appointees, and therefore thwarting the president's ability to fully staff the federal courts. I mean, it's a huge problem at the moment. I think 90% of the vacancies that currently exist are in states where there are one or two Republican senators. Texas, for instance, has 9 district court vacancies. That's almost unheard of. Pennsylvania has a whole host of, and Texas has 2 Republican senators. Pennsylvania has 1 Republican senator. And this is really causing the problem with the vacancies, the fact that Republican senators back home are refusing to play ball with the administration.
Well, doesn't this mean, though, this kind of blackmail that's been going on for some time, mean that the president and the Democrats have been putting up very uncontroversial centrist judges? Arguably, when they talk about the split on the Supreme Court between the 5 conservatives and the 4 liberals, I think that's very misleading if you look at the history of the Supreme Court with Thurgood Marshalls and the William O. Douglases. They were genuine liberals. I'm not sure that there are too many liberals on that court. In fact, most of them, I think, are centrists. So the whole political fulcrum, if you will, has moved so far to the right in the judiciary, and it's dominated by the Republicans and by conservatives. And is there any way that you can get around the blue slip? In other words, you can't even get to first base. And it doesn't seem like they really, as much as the Obama tries to accommodate them by having non-controversial centrist appointees, they still screw with him at any rate, don't they? So
Well, I do agree with you. I think in light of the unprecedented obstructionism by Republicans in merely consenting to the president's nominees, I do believe it's time to reconsider the blue slip rule in states and in situations where there's just huge numbers of vacancies. Yes, I think it's high time that the Judiciary Committee took a very close look at that.
Well, it would seem to me that if you're going to have a victory and have to go nuclear to get a victory, you might as well go big and try and get everything fixed at once rather than just have a small victory getting 3 judges to the D.C. Court of Appeals. That's just my opinion.
Well, I think, you know, fixing the blue slip rule would be important, but the problem is that not all nominees are at the same stage of the process.
I understand,
so it's, you know, it's not as if we can in one fell swoop take care of the entire problem, but I think getting these 3 nominees confirmed is a good place to start.
Well, Nan Aaron, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Nan Aaron, who's the president and founder of the Alliance for Justice, a national association of over 100 organizations working to promote and protect public interest in national policy, a leading voice in public interest law for over 30 years. She is the author of Liberty and Justice for All, Public Interest Law in the 1980s and Beyond. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an update on Wednesday's conference on retirement security in Washington ahead of the grand bargain that might cut Social Security.
Postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view. Indicate precisely what you mean to say. You're sincerely wasting away. Give me your answer, fill in a form, mine forevermore. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eric Kingston, who is a professor of social work at Syracuse University and the founding co-director of the Social Security Works, an organization which launches and staffs the Strengthened Social Security Coalition, which he co-chairs. He served as policy advisor to two presidential commissions, the 1982-1983 National Commission on Social Security Reform and the 1994 Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform, and also served on the Advisory Committee of the Social Security Administration's Transition Team. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Kingston.
Hi, Ian. Great to be here again.
And you've been in Washington at this gathering of a lot of stakeholders, I guess, in terms of what's happening with Social Security, or likely to happen with Social Security, at a time when Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin and Senator Patty Murray of Washington, the chairs of the House and Senate budget committees, finally sitting down for their first session of a conference committee supposed to hammer out a federal budget for fiscal 2014. And, of course, at the same time this is happening, the Social Security Administration announces that the size of the 2014 cost of living adjustment will be 1.5%, which is the fourth smallest since COLAs were introduced in 1975. So good timing, or important timing. Tell me about who was at the gathering.
Okay. This was a conference that was put together to move advocates and move members of Congress who are quite supportive onto the offensive. That for many years now, we've been running around saying, don't cut Social Security. Don't cut the cost of living adjustment. As you know, Ian, there's a proposal that would, had it been in effect, the cost of living adjustment, instead of being 1.5%, that huge sum, it would have been 1.2% roughly. There's a proposal called the chain CPI, which would cut the program and have huge impacts on every American, today's and tomorrow's beneficiaries. We're tired of saying, don't do this. We put together, and many of us who came to this conference, put together a story. The story is, Americans face a retirement income security crisis. Two-thirds of working Americans today are on a trajectory where they will not be able to maintain their standard of living in old age. And that assumes that they're working until age 65. So two-thirds of America, we have a huge deficit in retirement protection. We happen to have, that's sort of a part of the story. The second part of the story was, we actually have a system that does a darn good job. We built it because we wanted to protect against some things that we can't protect on our own. We want to protect against loss of income at retirement, or if disabled, or if a parent dies, all of that. And that's worked pretty darn well. We've made adjustments as needed. It's a popular system. It works. Problem is, so the second piece is, we have a system, we have a problem, we have a system that works, and we unveiled a number of plans today to expand Social Security. The speakers early on made a point that we are not a poor country. The problem is that the distribution of the growth in our country in the past 40 years has really gone to the top 1%. And middle-income people, working people, have seen their incomes largely stay flat or decline. We can afford this system. The problem we face is hugely important to the well-being of the society. And then the final point was, we have the politics to do this. With the leadership, I would say, many groups, and very importantly, the AFL-CIO, they're drawing a line. They are saying that any politician, Republican or Democrat, who votes to collect, to cut Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid, that they will not accept it, and they will come at them politically. They will run ads in their district. They will work to have them find a job where they can be more compassionate to their constituents. So the system, we have a problem. We have a solution, Social Security. We have some plans that can expand it sensibly. And we have some of the politics. So that came together. And at the end of the day, Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Harkin, Senator Schatz from Hawaii, quite a number of members of the House came and joined the discussion in a press conference saying that they were on board with talking about not just preventing the system from being cut, but really talking about it as an American institution that we need to call upon to protect Americans.
So, Eric Kingston, why has this not become the main debate in the United States when we have been apparently our politics are dominated by a phony debate over the deficit, that the sky is falling over the deficit, in spite of the fact that under President Obama, the deficit has shrunk from 11.1% of GDP in 2009 to 7.4% in 2012, and is projected to drop even further in the coming years. And we are not talking, while the Republicans want us to talk about deficits and debt and need to rein in government, and that's why they shut the government down and threatened to tank the economy recently. Yet we don't talk about the growing income inequality in this country, and we don't talk about the endangered middle class. And as you've just pointed out, we don't talk about how millions of Americans are facing a bleak future without any retirement income.
I'll start with one piece of data, and then I won't give you data. Between 1948 and 1979, the bottom 90% got about three quarters of the growth of the income. I received about three quarters of the growth. From 1979 till 2007, the top 1% got almost three quarters of the resources from economic growth. If you're in that top one or the top 0.1%, part of what's going on is that this deficit discussion, or blaming seniors, or fomenting phony intergenerational war, all of that distracts from the real problems we face. Massive shifts in income and wealth that have taken place in the last 40 years, wars that we didn't pay for where we put people at risk, tax cuts that have benefited the very well off. But if you don't want to discuss that, let's have a phony debate. Let's talk about austerity. Let's talk about why we cannot afford Social Security, Medicare. And while you're at it, let's play off young against old. So I would say that there's a basic obfuscation that takes place. And that I would say something else too, which is that I think those of us on the progressive side, and I do this all the time, I've just done it, we focus on data so often. We focus on telling the rational story. And I believe in rationality. I'm a professor. But we have to talk about the gut, the experience of the American people. Americans outside of Washington know that this system is needed. They say, whether Republicans or Democrats, they state preferences. They'd rather see taxes increased than benefits cut. So I think, and the conference was really a way of framing that discussion further today.
Again, I'm speaking with Eric Kingston, who is a professor of social work at Syracuse University and founding co-director of Social Security Works, an organization which launched and staffs the Strengthen Social Security Coalition, which he co-chairs. He served as policy advisor to two presidential commissions, the 1982-83 National Commission on Social Security Reform and the 1994 Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. And he also served on the advisory committee of the Social Security Administration's transition team. So, The phony debate, of course, has been fueled by this canard that's been absolutely drummed into the American people that you have to fix Social Security as though it has something to do with the deficit when it pays for itself. In fact, it pays for itself so much that the government's been borrowing against its surplus forever. And the idea that you need to cut Social Security is nonsense because the payroll taxes are projected to fall short of scheduled benefits by only 15% over the next 75 years, which is completely manageable, and it could be met by scrapping the cap, which is currently at $113,700 on incomes subject to the payroll tax. What's unfair about that is that millionaires pay the same payroll tax as the ordinary wage earners and average Americans. So is anybody looking at that obvious fix? I mean, we wouldn't...
Yes, every...
Go ahead. Sorry, okay. I didn't mean to go on.
No, it's good. Before I respond to that, let me just say at socialsecurityworks.org, you can see the conference. There's a YouTube that is up on it already, socialsecurityworks.org. And if you go there, sign on to Senator Sanders' petition. There is a petition now with probably over 400,000 people to members of Congress saying, do not cut these programs. So take a look at that, and you can see pieces of this conference that is they're really quite interesting. So the question again, Ian?
The question is that this is a phony debate about a problem that doesn't exist. And if it does exist, which is a shortfall in payroll taxes, that can be met by simply scrapping the cap at $113,700, which means that millionaires and billionaires pay the same payroll tax rate as ordinary Americans. So that seems perfectly doable and totally fair.
It is. But we would go beyond that. We at Social Security Works today, a number of people unveiled plans. We unveiled a plan that actually would provide across the board roughly 10% increases for everybody now and in the future that would cap that benefit at $150 a month. So if you're high income, you're not going to go above that. That includes family leave up to 12 weeks for I'm going to say is we need to dream and think of the society we want. Financing is a means. It is not the end in itself. The end is the kind of society we want for ourselves and especially our children. And the end is the kind of protections we need for ourselves in an uncertain world. So we talked about today, in our case, family leave, assuring that someone who works long and hard for 30 years in covered Social Security gets a benefit that's at least worth 125% of the poverty level, of providing up to $150 a month more in the system, of addressing some inequities in terms of widows, in terms of students. We talked about restoration of the student benefit, and we costed them out, and then we talked about taxes that are needed. And what we did in our case was say, we have a shortfall, we project, we added about almost as much in terms of new benefits that respond to the needs and wishes, we believe, of the American people. And then we said, look, there are some folks who have done extremely well in the last 40 years, and many of them are civic-minded. They're not evil necessarily. It is reasonable to place more expectations on them. It is reasonable to lift the cap. We would gradually lift that cap, and in doing that, we deal with a good chunk of the program. We talked about also putting a 20% tax on the $1,000,001 of people who have income of $1 million or more each year. Given the economy we're in, given the circumstances of most Americans, given that wealth has gone up to 225 times for the upper 1% compared to the median wealth holder, it's time to really talk about that in the country. Then we said also, let's have a slow increase in the payroll tax over 20 years, what it amounts to about 50 cents a week. Will we raise it over 20 years so that it goes up in 20 years to from 6.2% to 7.2% for employees and employers? A couple of other things. Let's put a portion of Social Security in the stock market, in equities, but in the way that the Federal Reserve Pension Plan does it, the Railroad Retirement Pension Plan does it. You do it in index funds, but you can get a higher rate of return. So putting these things together and a couple other things, we came up with enough money to address the projected shortfall, to expand benefits significantly, and have a small surplus after that. Now, there are lots of ways to do this, but the point is we can do it. We expect our economy to grow. If you look at the productivity growth of our society, it's been almost a straight line up in the last 80 years. The problem is those first 40 years, that was the productivity benefited working people in many, many ways. People got shorter work weeks. People got Social Security, a variety of things. The second 40 years, what we're seeing is a flattening out of income for most people and money going through the roof for the very well off. That has to be addressed if we're going to have a decent society. The other thing is you get these crocodile tears you're talking about, Ian, about we have to protect those young people. We have to protect young people. So what they're really saying is, look, we're projecting a shortfall out in 2033. And if we do nothing, we might have to cut benefits. We won't do nothing, but if we did nothing, no taxes, nothing, benefits would be cut by 25%. But since we have a problem in 2033, let's eviscerate the program now to protect the young. It's young people who are going to be most harmed by the kinds of proposals that are being talked about to cut this program. And it's young people who will benefit most, and who will have an expanding economy, a moderately expanding economy, and can afford, as a society, we will be able to afford to do more if we do it thoughtfully, planfully, and we look at policies that are fair to all Americans, not just to the very well off.
So just in closing then, Eric Kingston, given that the Koch brothers, the billionaires, are funding a program to encourage kids, it's called Generation Opportunity, to encourage college kids and young Americans not to sign up for health care. And we know that for the longest time, the libertarians and others have been pushing this line that you'll never have Social Security. I think it's been called by the right wing in this country a Ponzi scheme. Various Tea Party Republicans have used that refrain. Just in the last minute, what can you say to young people to reassure them that it's going to be there, and what's the best way to counter the kind of malignancy from the Koch brothers, who, by the way, will not pick up the tab for any of these kids that they're telling that shouldn't have health insurance and won't be getting Social Security?
Their notion of protecting younger generations is to protect younger, very wealthy people in the future. This is crocodile tears. I think to young people, you have to ask, do you think this federal government, do you think the United States government will continue 20, 30, 40 years into the future? And the usual answer is yes, we believe so, or 100 years in the future. Well, if you do, the full faith and credit of the United States government is behind this. You also, if people continue to work, they pay into the system. If the economy grows as we expect, it becomes easier to provide this. But I think the good thing about young people in the polling data is young people understand, even though they've been fed the pablum of the system is going to go broke, but even with that, they generally want to see further protection in the system because they understand their grandparents, their parents, are going to need it. Now, I'm concerned about protecting it because I think the young people of our country are going to need it even more as we go forward, as we've lost. Private pensions have basically Defined benefits are going down. The 401k plan is a terrible disaster. The average retirement savings of American households, is working households, is $3,000. If they have a 401k, about $10,000, $12,000. This is not going to bring us into a safe retirement. So I would look at the system in terms of, I think from the beginning, we've talked about a system that grows and changes. It's like the highway system. It's there. We can't imagine it not being there, which is part of the problem. You don't start talking about ripping up the U.S. highway system when you find the bumps in the road. You fix it. With Social Security, we make periodic adjustments. It's time to talk about not just dealing with financing, but what do we want to protect? What do we want to protect our families as we move forward? So, I would encourage them to dream.
Okay.
Not listen to the garbage.
Okay, Eric Kingston, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Eric Kingston, a professor of social work at Syracuse University and the founding co-director of Social Security Works, an organization which launches and staffs the Strengthen Social Security Coalition, which he co-chairs. He served as policy advisor to two presidential commissions, the 1982 and 83 National Commission on Social Security Reform and the 1994 Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. And he also serves on the advisory committee of the Social Security Administration's transition team. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the arrest of five Uyghurs in China and the Han-Chinese relations with the Muslim-Chinese minorities. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Drew Gladney, who's a professor of anthropology at Pomona College. Previously, he was president of the Pacific Basin Institute at Pomona, and prior to that was professor of Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii, as well as senior research fellow at the East-West Center. He's author of the award-winning book, Muslim Chinese, Ethnic Nationalism in the People's Republic, as well as Ethnic Identity in China, the Making of a Muslim Minority Nationality, and Dislocating China, Muslims, Minorities, and Other Subaltern Subjects. Welcome to Background Briefing, Drew Gladney.
Thanks for having me.
And the Chinese Public Security Bureau have announced the arrest of five ethnic Uyghurs who are being described as Islamic jihadists responsible for this audacious attack at the foot of the Tiananmen Gate, which is near the political heart of the nation. What's your sense of obviously we have to, you know, take some of these charges with some skepticism, given the rule of law in China or the lack thereof. But do you think this is a terrorist attack and this is something that might be a harbinger of more to come?
Well, if it is a terrorist attack, it's a very unusual one. Apparently the driver was accompanied by his mother and his wife, and he's some kind of a delivery driver. The license plates were from Xinjiang. He's been identified as a Uyghur, so the immediate suspicion is it is connected to some sort of terrorism or separatism. But I think, again, it might be jumping to conclusions too quickly. The problem in China, of course, is once they've arrested a bunch of Uyghurs, they'll come out with some confessions and they'll close the case and everybody will suspect that Uyghurs are always involved in terrorism. And I think that that could be very misleading in this case. It seems very idiosyncratic. It doesn't have the markings of a sort of jihadist suicide bomber with, you know, bomb suicide vests or bombs in the car. The car exploded on impact. They say there was gasoline in the car. But there's still a lot of questions left to be answered before anyone draws any conclusions.
Well, they've also said that in the car that Usman Hassan, his wife Gulzik Jini, and his mother Gawurhan Rehim, which are obviously Uyghur names, they died when it went up in flames. But they also have said that there were gas canisters and two knives, metal clubs, and a banner bearing religious extremism messages. Now, the police who have arrested these five Uyghur men at an undisclosed location on Monday, say they've already confessed and they've discovered more long knives and a jihadist flag in this temporary residence where they were arrested. So again, I guess, you know, you just have to take all this with a grain of salt, right? We don't know whether it's real or what.
Right? Well, we do know an explosion took place.
Right.
We do know that Uyghurs were involved. The problem, of course, is that there's this sort of mass hysteria in China about Muslim jihadists and radical Islam and Uyghur separatism. And the media sort of fans the flames, and it's really hard to see through the smoke to actually find out what happens in these incidents. What's unusual about this, of course, is that often these incidents take place in the far west, in Xinjiang, and this is in the heart of China. And that's what makes people very worried. I would just call attention to the fact that even if the case that this guy was some sort of crazed person and he decided to do this, it's still a very low-level kind of attack with knives and a car on tourists. It's not obviously an example of a well-coordinated, internationally orchestrated separatist movement or radical Islamic movement. It's clearly the act of a very disturbed individual. The problem, of course, for China is that many Uyghurs are very upset about the government policy in the region, not just in China, but especially more vocal outside of China. And one suspects that these kinds of rather isolated and idiosyncratic incidents will continue unless something changes in China's policy in the western region of Xinjiang, where the Uyghurs live.
Again, I'm speaking with Drew Gladney, who's a professor of anthropology at Pomona College. Previously, he was president of the Pacific Basin Institute at Pomona, and prior to that was professor of Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii, as well as senior research fellow at the East-West Center. He's the author of the award-winning book, Muslim Chinese Ethnic Nationalism in the People's Republic, and we're talking about this car that charged into crowds at Tiananmen Gate, killing two tourists, injuring 40 people. The people in the car died when it burst into flames. That was a husband, his wife, and his mother. However, five other people were arrested at an undisclosed location. It's unsure what connection they had to that. And in general, Drew Gladney, when you say that the Chinese people and the Chinese press are playing up Islamic terrorism, how does it compare here to the United States? Because we have a certain level of hysteria, and you know they're passing laws in Kansas and places like that to ban Sharia law when nobody's even promoting it. I mean, so compare the paranoia in the U.S. and the paranoia in China vis-a-vis Islamic extremism.
Oh, of course, China has never had a 9/11 incident like we've had. And so it's not surprising that Americans often jump to conclusions when there's a major incident that looks like terrorism. But China has had a long history and series of uprisings and civil unrest in the region known as Xinjiang, the Uyghur autonomous region. And the government continues to portray these incidents as orchestrated from abroad, as inspired by radical Islam. People that look at this say that it looks a lot like civil unrest throughout China. The government admits that there's over 100,000 incidents a year now in China that are called mass incidents in the Chinese text that are unrelated more to personal grievances labor disputes, housing dislocation, and this kind of general sense that people have very little recourse but to do something crazy to get the government's attention. Recently, a man burned himself to death in his house instead of being moved, refusing to move, a kind of self-immolation, which we normally have seen among Tibetans. So, you know, these kinds of isolated incidents, when they're connected to a kind of larger plot conspiracy, I think are very, it's a very counterproductive thing to do, because it then makes people even more suspicious. It divides the population, and the Uyghurs, who already feel marginalized and ostracized, will feel that even more.
So would there be a similarity between what the Uyghurs are feeling in the sense that, and in the way that the Tibetans are reacting to what many have referred to as a form of ethnic cleansing, where the Han Chinese are migrating at the encouragement of the government, and at government expense, I imagine, into Tibet? And I believe that the Han Chinese are also migrating into Xinjiang, where most of China's ethnic Uyghurs are.
Yeah, I mean, the migration of Han into Xinjiang, the Uyghur autonomous region, is a much larger rate than in Tibet. Tibetans are still a majority population in their own autonomous region of Tibet. I think ethnic cleansing is a way too strong a term. Indeed, China, the communist government of China, has a very strong nationalities policy, and they celebrate ethnic diversity, and they try to protect languages and cultures and religions. A lot of these problems in the region are often the lack of oversight, the lack of carrying out these policies, which at times can be quite enlightened and progressive, particularly, you know, celebrating minority history and language and culture and even religion, protecting temples and mosques. You know, during the 1960s and 70s, there was this terrible period of the Cultural Revolution, and every Chinese regrets that period, and it's critical of the wide-scale crackdown on religion and on ethnicity. And if anything, you go to many temples and mosques in China, and they're full of worshipers. It's just in Xinjiang where we have this political issue, where the restrictions on religion are much more severe. And the Uyghurs feel like their culture and their religion is under attack, and it is vulnerable to being overwhelmed by these large populations of Han migrants. You know, it's hard to tell what's going to happen in the future, but it's clear that this migration is going to continue. And the government needs to find some way to both, you know, advance the country and develop the country, but also protect the rights and the identities of the peoples that are in these regions, the local peoples.
Well, it seems, though, Drew Gladney, that those that study the Uyghurs and the ethnic minorities in China are concerned that this attack at the heart of the nation, if you will help bolster the contention on the part of the Chinese government that Uyghur Islamists have allied with a terrorist group known as the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. Give us a sense of, if you've just pointed out that the Chinese government have been very careful to nurture minorities and address their cultural needs. But who is this East Turkestan Islamic Movement, and do you think that that the authorities are going to make life difficult for Uyghurs who are not necessarily Islamists, but are calling for better conditions for their minority?
I think it's really misleading to link every isolated incident among the Uyghurs or among Muslims in China to this shadowy organization, which may not even exist anymore. It was a very shadowy organization whose origins are rather murky. There's no identifiable members today, no headquarters. No one knows where it's based. And it did receive much attention just after 9/11, when it was identified as an international terrorist network, some people are very suspicious that that played into the hands of those who wanted to suggest that there was an international terrorist organization operating in China. The evidence of that is very specious when we look at the small-scale nature and the lack of a sort of jihadist signature in any of these incidents. We're talking about knives, in this case a car. In Xinjiang, we've seen larger-scale incidents, but generally these take the form of riots, the largest of which was in 2009 on July 5th when Uyghurs were very upset about the mistreatment of Uyghur workers in southern China. But this spilled into the streets, and I think people were shocked at the level of intensity of anger among the Uyghur population towards the Han and the kind of building up of resentment. And it had nothing to do with Islam. It had nothing to do with independence. It had nothing to do with jihad or separatism. It was about it was a labor issue. It was about a mistreatment, a social rights issue. So what's been happening in China since 2009 is a kind of rethinking of the whole policy towards Western Xinjiang, Western China's development. But there really hasn't been any change in policy. And these incidents keep happening again and again on a small scale and on a large scale. So it's clear that the government has to rethink this policy and make some changes on the ground if they're going to avoid these kinds of incidents in the future.
Well, you know, the United States, of course, designated this murky, perhaps non-existent group, East Turkestan Islamic Movement, as a terrorist organization. I don't know whether we created the China's nemesis here, but...
we certainly supported it.
This is exactly. Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Drew Gladney.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Drew Gladney, who's a professor of anthropology at Pomona College. Previously, he was president of the Pacific Basin Institute at Pomona, and prior to that was professor of Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii, as well as senior research fellow at the East-West Center. He's the author of the award-winning book, Muslim Chinese Ethnic Nationalism in the People's Republic. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianthemasters.com, where you can also contact me. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.